Ohio Governor Mike DeWine says no to changes in the state's child labor laws. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our weekly news review, why the governor vetoed the measure. And will he sign a bill that seeks to cut the grace period for voters to return absentee ballots? Plus, how Cincinnati police launched their fleet of drones and Burrow is back. Is last week's win keeping Bengals' playoff hopes alive? Joining me now to get the news review started are Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler and reporter and producer Joe Ingles. Welcome back, Karen and Joe.
Hey.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much for being here. Karen, I mentioned this bill that Governor DeWine vetoed related to Ohio's child labor laws. What would this bill have allowed?
Well, this bill would have allowed 14 and 15-year-olds to work past 7 p.m. all the way to 9 p.m. on school nights. Right now, 7 o'clock is the limit, and they can work longer periods during breaks and summer and that sort of stuff. But this would really set that limit for year-round. And Republican sponsors had said that they wanted to have this opportunity because work is important and that they thought that it could help deal with some of the staffing shortages that businesses are facing. Democrats and those who are opposed to this said that they were worried about the effect of longer working hours on kids and also said that it wouldn't help with some of the most in-demand jobs that Ohio needs to fill. So DeWine said that he was concerned about this. He likes the idea of kids learning to work, but there's a balance between kids learning to work and getting those skills, but also making sure that they study and they stay ahead in school. So he said that current law is working. There was no reason to change it.
The veto happened, of course, but Karen, were there enough votes for this bill to override the governor's veto?
Well, in a way, I'm not even sure what the effect of a veto override would be, because, yes, it did pass with veto-proof majorities in the House and Senate, but federal law would have to be changed for this to go into effect. The Federal Fair Labor Standards Act would have to change. And so at the same time that this bill was passed, lawmakers also passed a resolution to urge Congress to change that federal law. DeWine can't weigh in on resolutions like that because they're not laws. They don't have the effect of law. And so unless the federal law changes, there really isn't a whole lot that the state law would do other than to show that the state supports this. So I'm not sure exactly what the plan is, but it did pass with veto-proof majorities in the House and Senate.
Okay. Well, Karen, you reported on another important issue for children this week. I think many of us assume there are laws restricting where sex offenders can live in regard to children. But I was surprised to learn there's no current law related to how close they can live to their victims. What would this proposal do that you reported on?
Yeah, the laws on where sexual offenders, those who are convicted of sex crimes and crimes against sexual crimes against children, they're complicated because there have been other laws that have been passed over time that further restrict. The older the conviction, the less restrictions. But one of the things that's been out there is that there has been no restriction on where a child sex offender or a sex offender can live in relation to their victim. There are rules on, like, you can't live near a preschool or things like that, but not according to where the victim lives. And so this was a bill that came from a Northeast Ohio representative, Roy Klopfenstein, who said that he was approached by the family of a six-year-old in his district who basically was afraid to play in her backyard because the house that she lives in butts up against the neighbor who sexually assaulted her. Oh. And so he said that it was time to ban people from living within 2,000 feet of their victim. And this got overwhelming support in the House and now moves on to the Senate.
Was there any opposition to this?
There were two Democrats who were opposed. One of them, Cecil Thomas, Representative Cecil Thomas, a former Cincinnati police officer, said he was concerned about some of the language, how it affects people who unknowingly have those folks who have been convicted of sexual offenses living in their homes. And he said the language should be that the tenant or the owner of the property or the tenant needed to make sure that they were knowingly letting this happen. And he said there was also a concern about, would this relate to offenders who were basically keeping tabs on their victims to make sure that they don't break the law? But is that, you know, a little too close for what they should be doing? So, but overwhelmingly, it did pass and only two votes against.
What's next with this proposal?
again, it goes to the Senate now, but I don't think we'll see this one for a little while. I mean, it has to go through the full Senate process, so it'll be next year before we see this one again.
Okay. Well, Joe, tell us about this bill that would shield lawmakers' addresses on public websites. What's that about?
Well, this is a bill that basically, you know, there's been a lot of problem lately with lawmakers in other states, especially the Hortman case, different states where people have, lawmakers have been killed because someone has gone after them. And here in Ohio, we haven't thankfully had anything that bad, but there have been lawmakers who have received things in the mail that, you know, like powder and things like that. There have been threats. So this bill basically is meant to speak to that. And we know there are like public websites, you know, the Board of Elections website, for example, where you can go on there and you can find a lawmaker where they're registered to vote, and someone who wanted to do something bad could use that information against them. Right now in Ohio, police officers and judges, for example, they are allowed to have their information off of those websites. They are private. And so you can't go on there and find where a police officer lives because that can be scrubbed off there. But the lawmakers don't have that advantage. So this bill would give politicians at the state house the opportunity to get their name, their address, all that information that goes with their name. That would go off the website's front page. And the way it would work is it wouldn't be unavailable. You could still get it, just like you can get police officers' information right now. But the thing is, you would have to submit a formal request for that would also let the politician know that, hey, Joe Ingles filed a request to get your information about where you live, and then they could act accordingly. There are reasons where you might want to know where a public, politician lives. For example, if you're trying to figure out if they live in the right district, if they're running for office, something like that. So there are reasons that information is helpful to reporters in public, in public request settings. But the thing is that this would make it so that they're treated more like the police officers and others who have some protection.
So what's the status of that legislation, Joe?
Well, it right now it's kind of, you know, in the beginning stages. It's not going to pass anytime soon. It won't pass before the end of the year. But it's been put out there. And the idea is to, get it out there, get it passed within the next year.
Karen, let's talk about another piece of legislation. We've talked before about this bill that would change Ohio's grace period for absentee ballots. Remind us what that would do.
It basically eliminates the 4-day period during which ballots can arrive at boards of elections. Ballots need to be postmarked by election day, but they have an extra 4 days to get to the Board of Elections to still be counted. And so that period was in place. It had actually been reduced, I believe, in previous legislation, because sometimes there are delays in the Postal Service. You get your absentee ballot, you mail it on time, but sometimes things happen beyond your control and it doesn't get to the post office by election, or it doesn't get to the Board of Elections by election day. Well, this is an effort to try to change that so that all ballots would have to be in by election day, except for overseas and military ballots. Those are protected under a federal law. And Republican lawmakers who sponsored this had said that they were concerned about a threat of litigation from the Trump administration. He had signed an executive order earlier in the year saying that election day is the day the ballot should be counted and all ballots should be in-house by election day. Now, what's interesting about this is that there are still provisional ballots and you still have time after election day if you voted provisionally to go in and prove your identity. So you have 4 days to do that. Obviously, the military and overseas ballots come in when they come in. And an official count is not produced until weeks after election day. So there are certainly some questions that have been raised about why eliminate this 4-day grace period, which can help I think there were 8,000 ballots that would not have been counted last year, according to Secretary of State Frank Rose, who supports this bill, if the law had been in effect back last year. So DeWine was asked yesterday if he is going to veto it. He almost never makes a comment like he's going to veto something or not at an unrelated event. So we still have to wait to see. But the clock is definitely ticking on that one.
Okay. Well, Joe, Karen just mentioned President Trump and an executive order. President Trump recently floated the idea of allowing 50-year mortgages as a way to try to make home ownership more affordable. You talked to some Ohio affordable housing advocates. What do they think of that?
Well, they think it might be helpful to a small sliver of buyers. What you're doing is you're stringing out what, you know, now you can get a 30-year mortgage. You're taking that to 50 years. And the first, you know, two decades or so, you're going to be paying almost all interest on it, like you do on a current loan. You pay all that interest up front. So they're saying, okay, if you're someone who's, you know, $200 can make a big difference in, you know, whether you can buy a house, $200 a month can make a big difference in whether you can buy a house or not, this might help you. But they said it's really not going to help the people who are right now dealing with the not being able to find a home in their price range or not being able to get the, you know, the homes aren't available out there. It's not speaking to any of those things.
Did they have ideas for changes that would be more helpful to people?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things they said is they could close the loopholes that serve to deny people mortgages. Oftentimes, there are loopholes that are there to prevent people from being in the pool. They said you could close those. And the big thing, though, has always been to increase the stock of affordable housing for lower income homeowners. And we have seen this happening in cities throughout Ohio where there are communities that are popping up where you can get a more affordable home. It's usually a new construction or it's a neighborhood that, you know, they've gone into and kind of fixed up the homes. They're saying that that's more of an answer to this problem than offering 50-year mortgages.
Hmm. Well, Karen, Ohio got a report card this week from a group that lobbies for more road safety laws. What was the state's overall grade?
Well, the state, along with 37 other states, got a yellow or caution warning from this group called Advocates for Highway and Auto Safety. And this group is a coalition of consumer health, insurance, law enforcement groups that lobby for better road safety laws. And they said that they liked Ohio's distracted driving law that's been in effect for a couple of years, which there's evidence that's showing that that is helping drop down distracted driving. And they also liked Ohio's traffic camera laws, even though a lot of communities are no longer using traffic cameras. And state lawmakers have talked about limiting speed and red light cameras in terms of their use. But this group is concerned about Ohio's lack of a helmet law for motorcycles, also concerned about some of the laws relating to kids in cars, rear-facing car seats, kids in the back seat. Ohio doesn't have as strict laws on those that this group would like to see. And the big one is seatbelt laws. This group wants to see primary enforcement of seatbelt laws, meaning a police officer can pull you over and give you a ticket for not wearing a seatbelt, not adding that onto another citation. And so that's their real concern. They say half of all accidents, people who die in those accidents are not wearing seatbelts. And they said that would really save a lot of lives.
Well, and they pointed out that a whole lot of people have died in crashes in Ohio in recent years, haven't they?
Yeah, I mean, it was almost 12,000 people who have died in crashes in Ohio in the last 10 years. And more than 1,100 people were killed on Ohio roads last year. And there's a real economic impact, not only the emotional impact and how this tears apart people and families and the grief of this is awful, but it costs about $12.1 billion motor vehicle crashes in Ohio each year. And so that's why this group says it's really important to try to strive for the green light or the good rating that they give out. And they only gave that out to 8 states, as a matter of fact. 9 states got red or danger ratings. So there are a lot of states that are doing worse than Ohio, but most states were in that yellow range, meaning there could be improvements made.
Didn't Ohio just pass a measure that requires driver's ed classes? Does this group think that could help?
Well, and I specifically asked about that because they were concerned about the effect of laws on young drivers. And what the group's president told me is because there's no standard for driver's education, one program could be great, one program could be that driver's ed may not help that much, even if you require it for people up to age 21. They would rather see a minimum age for a learner's permit or more supervised driving, less nighttime driving, limiting the number of passengers in cars with people who don't have their full driver's licenses yet. So they said that would be a more effective and safer way to go than just driver's ed.
Okay, well, Joe, I know you were in our neck of the woods recently. We heard a lot this summer about Governor DeWine's efforts to work with local cities, including Cincinnati, to target violent crime and bring state resources on board to do that. Can you tell us what has been happening and how the governor says that whole approach is working?
Yeah, it's really fascinating. I went out in Cincinnati recently with the multi-agency crime task force that is working in Cincinnati, Cleveland, and Dayton right now. And basically what they're doing is the Cincinnati Police, the Hamilton County Sheriff, the Ohio Highway Patrol, they're marshaling all of their resources and they're working together and they're mining each other's strengths. It's not like they come in and kick Cincinnati out and the Highway Patrol takes over. It's everyone's working together. They have the Highway Patrol puts their helicopter up in the air to help, you know, fight crime that way. They can actually see people on the ground and what they're doing. And then they have the agencies that, you know, federal and state agencies. So they have like ATF and they have the state liquor agencies, different agencies, the parole authority, that kind of thing, that all these agencies are getting the data together. They're really working together to bring that information to the actual officers on the ground. So they go out and they see someone roll through a stop sign or they see something that just didn't look right. They can stop them right there. And in the short time that I was in the car with the officer, you know, going on their runs, we saw someone who had fired shots and then discarded the gun. There was a manhunt for him. They knew exactly where he was, so it's not really much of a manhunt. But they were watching from the helicopter, and they had thermal imaging so that the officers on the ground could actually see where he was. And they were able to apprehend that suspect without anyone getting hurt. There were some drug busts that went down that night. It was just really fascinating to see how it all worked together.
And I know these task forces have led to a number of arrests. How many of these suspects does the governor describe as violent criminals? Is that who these task groups are really going after?
Yeah, that's who they're going after. They're really going after the violent criminals and the repeat offenders. And if you look at the kind of things that they're pulling in, they are felony charges. They've had sexual assault, murder, you know, all kinds of different horrible crimes that people have allegedly committed, and they've been able to arrest in those cases. And it's been kind of an effective way, according to the governor, an effective way to get some of these repeat offenders off the street so they're not out there causing, because apparently the people who are the repeat offenders, they're causing a lot of the crime, a disproportionate amount of the crime.
So is this an ongoing effort in these cities where the state is collaborating?
It is. And from everyone that I talked to, it was working well. The local police that were working with the Highway Patrol liked having the assistance, and they were all working together. And like I said, playing to each other's strengths. And so it was helpful to them, they said, in trying to do this. And as this gets more and more well known, I think we're going to see more cities going to this method of trying to hit those crime hotspots. Because when you can get in there and you can work with the other agencies and have more assistance to get what you need faster, it just makes it easier for the officers to apprehend people.
Well, I have been talking with Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler and reporter and producer Joe Ingles. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Up next, a look inside the Cincinnati Police Department's Drone Command Center. This is Cincinnati Edition. It used to be that expensive helicopters were the only way law enforcement could conduct surveillance from the skies. Now the Cincinnati Police Department has a whole fleet of drones for that work. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now to give us a look inside the department's Drone Command Center is Cincinnati Enquirer reporter David Ferraro. Welcome back, David.
Good afternoon, Lucy.
Always great to have you here. When did the Cincinnati Police Department launch its drone program?
So officially, the Drone as First Responders program, as they call it, launched at the end of July, July 28th. So just at the end of this summer, amid a lot of discussions, just building off what we were talking about earlier on the show, on discussions of crime in downtown Cincinnati.
Right. And how many flights have they launched in that time?
By this point, more than 4,000.
More than 4,000 since the end of July.
Oh, yeah. They're launching day and night. They are at this point staffing the command center for the drones at about 24/7 whenever they can get the shifts filled. But these drones are going up maybe 7, 8, 9 times an hour as much as they can to respond to these different calls for service all around, primarily the west side of Cincinnati, north side, West Price Hill, Lower Price Hill, downtown over the Rhine.
How many drones do they have?
Right now, they got a fleet of 9 drones, but by early next year, they're planning on adding that another 13, coming to about a total of 22 drones, assuming no other funding comes in to even add more drones to the fleet. And that's spread across 3 different docks in those neighborhoods I just mentioned, Northside, Price Hill, and the sort of downtown over the Rhine area.
Interesting. So does the public have access to these flight plans to understand where these drones are going?
They do. So the Cincinnati Police Department contracts with Skydio for all these drones, which is a large vendor for a lot of different drone programs around the country. And they publish these flight records online. However, when you look at the dashboard, it's just a mess of different maps with flight paths. So I took a look at the flight paths to get an idea of where these drones are going, how often they're flying, and looked at calls for service to see, okay, what are these drones actually responding to?
And what are they responding to?
A little bit of everything. So it's both ends of the spectrum when it comes to what police are responding to. I mean, I think like when you see police on TV, you think to yourself, okay, you know, it's always these high-packed action events. But it's a lot of mundane things that police respond to, like traffic hazards. There's something in the middle of the interstate or someone butt-dialed 911, so to speak. And those calls take a lot of time. So the drones are responding out to some of these incidents and being the first eyes on the scene to say, okay, do we actually need to dispatch an officer on scene here, or can we close out the call and move on?
Yeah. Can you tell us about some more of the specifics that you observed or learned about in your reporting on this? I mean, didn't you say potential home break-ins are something that they get a lot of calls about?
That's right. So if an officer, you know, has to drive to a home that might be 5 or 10 minutes away, that delays the time they can get on scene, maybe catch a suspect and if an alarm is going off. So this drone could be up and in the air and on scene within a minute. And drones are responding to home break-ins, to shot spotter activations, which are those networks of microphones across the city detecting any gunfire that might go off. They're responding to shootings like over at the Privy nightclub over in Over the Rhine earlier this past month. And responding to these urgent situations to get there on the scene, relay information to officers, and potentially help effectuate an arrest.
And I guess sometimes, especially with the home break-in, it's a false alarm. They can prevent an officer from having to go at all. Is that part of the equation too?
That is. And sometimes in these cases, they might have a drone out there. Maybe they'll put the thermal camera on and see, okay, we don't see anyone in the home, but we might want to send an officer out just to be safe. So it hasn't necessarily eliminated all officer responses to certain calls like that, because it's kind of a better safe than sorry sort of approach. But it has been able to speed up the turnaround on getting these things cleared.
Yeah. What about things like obstructions in the road or even mental health calls? Can they help with stuff like that?
They can. So these drones are equipped with microphones, with speakers. So there have been times that I was told when I spoke with the drone squad that these drones are responding to mental health crises. You know, they recalled one instance to me to where they knew there was someone who called in and said, my son is having a mental health emergency. His phone's pinging over here. They were able to get the drone over there, kind of get an eye on him. And they thought that he might be armed. So they were able to get information to officers to let them know, okay, how do we best approach the situation so that way it doesn't escalate and we end up with a poor outcome. And they were able to de-escalate that situation and get him the help he needs with the city's response to crisis teams.
Wow. So when you mentioned that you looked at this data with these flight patterns, these maps that I'm sure would be very confusing to me, tell us what you did with all that and what you kind of found out, sussed out of all that.
Yeah, absolutely. So without getting too highly technical, so the flight paths show the exact way that these drones are flying, right? So you could see the drone left at this time, took off, flew around here, did a little loop-de-loop around a skyscraper, came back. But at the same time, the city publishes all the different calls that police are responding to, so with the coordinates. So I was able to say, okay, if there's a call here, a drone flight here, and this is the only thing going on at this time in this place, that's what the drone was responding to with a pretty high deal of probability either way. And I was able to get an idea of, okay, these drones are responding to different shot spotter calls, or they're performing patrols around over the Rhine, and getting a bit of perspective is, all right, you know, these are where the hot spots are. Like Cincinnati police said they would be targeting parts of over the Rhine this summer with their different pivot programs and strategic initiatives to combat an uptick in crime. And you can see the drones have been a part of that and helping patrol, keep an eye from above, and sort of getting officers on the ground where they need to be, but from up in the air as well.
Yeah. Well, and you talked about some of these cases where they've been helpful. Is this helping with officer staffing issues? I mean, Cincinnati Police Department still has staffing problems, right?
That's right. So the department's still about 15% short of where it should be in terms of authorized officers. And that follows a nationwide trend. A lot of departments nationwide are experiencing a shortage. And what this allows officers to do is focus on higher priority calls and close out some of the lower priority calls quicker, as well as get additional resources that necessarily isn't just boots on the ground, but is also just quicker. Okay, let's send a drone out there, see what's going on. It's not even worth having an officer go out there and deal with this. We can just have the drone close it out and it's done. Like if someone said, oh, there's a cone in the middle of the highway, and by the time that they get out there, someone had hit it with their car and it's on the side.
Yeah. But so it sounds like these aren't in any way designed to replace police officers, but kind of enhance what they can do, so it's not so much manpower going in different directions that might be waste of time.
I think that's right. I think a lot of departments that are considering these drone programs are looking at it as an additional way to bring in more officers as dedicated drone officers, because the Cincinnati Police Department has about 4 pilots right now that their whole job from clock in to clock out is they fly drones and they respond to calls. And they are looking at expanding that. And other departments where they've done this, it appears to be the case that they're not necessarily taking away foot patrol positions and taking away beat cops, but they're putting more efforts into, okay, this is a tool that we can use to assist and help our officers on the ground, as well as take some of the pressure off.
I have to say, I thought the photos in your story were fascinating, because they are they using Xbox controllers? Is that what they're using to pilot these drones?
That's right. So they have Xbox One controllers, which I did find pretty interesting. But they're able to pilot them remotely. The live feed comes right in on their monitor. And these are highly technical drones. I mean, they have really great cameras. You know, from 400 feet above, they can zoom in and make out the numbers on a license plate. And they have thermal imaging, so if they want to see the heat that radiates off of someone's body, if there was a suspect that maybe had fled and is hiding under a car, they can bring the drone out and they can see that from quite a distance away.
Wow. Well, I'm terrible at Xbox, so I guess I'd be a bad drone pilot too if that were my job. Who has expressed concerns about these drones? I've got to imagine that there are some people who are maybe a little nervous about this.
Definitely. So there have been privacy concerns raised. So I spoke with some different privacy advocates as well as citizens who have talked about concerns with over-surveillance, about mission creep, whereas something like this, as I was just saying, kind of starts as a tool but eventually sort of develops into something larger than it was intended to be. And the fact that these drones right now are, you know, might necessarily be patrolling or targeting certain neighborhoods more so just because of, you know, let's say ShotSpotter, which, you know, has microphones in only certain neighborhoods. If these drones are going to respond to calls in those neighborhoods only, they're going to experience the effects of this drone policing and surveillance more so than neighborhoods that wouldn't have those microphones. And I think that the people that I spoke with express concerns about what the drones are actually doing. They'll see them flying above. Maybe they'll see the red and blue lights, but they don't really know where this drone's going and what it's responding to. Is it looking at me or is it going somewhere else?
Yeah. And is it just generally privacy too? Like, what are these? Are they recording this information? What can they see me in my backyard? Stuff like that.
Right. So the drones are always recording. So if you do see a Cincinnati police drone flying above you, it is recording. Generally, when they're flying en route to a scene, they'll have the camera horizontal at the skyline. However, it is a wide, you know, field of view, so they are picking up things around it. And there are not many restrictions right now nationwide, but specifically in Ohio, as to what maybe a warrant would be required for when it comes to surveillance with drones and what's, you know, a breach of privacy versus reasonable expectation, lack thereof of privacy. So there's still some questions to be answered to that. And there's ongoing discussions, I know, in the State House in terms of bills and all that are going through and how to address that. But right now it's still up in the air.
You mentioned red and blue lights. I we're wondering, how do you tell the difference between a police drone and maybe just some creepy guy's drone who's flying it around? Are they marked? I mean, should you be able to see that from the ground if it's a Cincinnati police drone?
They say that they have red and blue lights, and I have seen them. I don't know necessarily when I've seen some of the police drones flying above that's as visible during the daytime hours as it might be in the nighttime hours. To be able to tell. And also, it still is unclear exactly what these drones are responding to. So if you see a drone above your house, you might say, okay, I wonder where that's going. There's no real way to tell right now until maybe the flight path comes out a couple days later. And if you do a little bit of, you know, look into it with the calls for services, you know, as I was mentioning, to get an idea of, okay, this is what the drone was going to.
Yeah. Are there any rules forbidding private drone operators from sticking lights on theirs to make it look like a police drone?
I don't think that's been addressed yet. There are restrictions in terms of, you know, I think impersonating a police officer, maybe there could be a case made for, you're trying to pretend to look like a police drone.
Yeah.
And there are restrictions in terms of, like, police drones have an exception that other drone operators don't, which is that they don't have to stay within the field of view. So typically, if you're flying your own private personal drone around, you have to keep it within your own eyesight, beyond visual line of sight. And police drones have an exception to do that, and that's how they're able to fly them from HQ far away.
Well, because you noted in your story that these police drones are programmed in a way that they can't crash into a building. And I think, like, just with a regular drone, you could, if you're not watching it, you could crash into something, right? Is that part of, I mean, am I right about that? Is there a difference there in this drone technology versus the stuff you can go buy off Amazon or whatever?
Oh, definitely. I mean, there's all scales of it. You know, the police drones they're using are the same kind of drones. Skydio contracts with the military, so these drones are being used across the country, but also overseas. And they have AI in them that allow them to detect buildings, make out 3D maps, and such like that. And obviously, you could find a drone off Amazon that all it does is get up in the air. But
yeah.
Some of these private drones do have highly technical software like that as well. But the Skydio drones are equipped with a parachute, which came in handy last month. A hawk had thought that the Skydio drone that was flying over Price Hill was actually some form of bird, some form of prey, and went and grabbed it. And it ended up deploying the parachute, scared the hawk off, and then it landed gracefully in the middle of Glenway Ave.
Wow. Okay. Greedy hawk. So how much does this whole program cost? And you said they're adding a bunch more drones. How much is that going to cost?
Right. So far through 2033, it's about a $4.8 million program. And that includes a lot of different things. That includes each drone, which, as we've calculated out, because it's not exactly clear how much they're spending on each individual item because of the way that the contracts are redacted based on the agreements the city has made with Skydio and Axon, who's the other vendor. But about $62,000 is how we've calculated the approximate cost of these drones.
That's per drone?
Per drone.
Yeah.
And then you have the cost of the command center, which includes that technology, you know, the Xbox controllers to fly them remotely. It's about $200,000 a year. And then they need to be able to maintain this distance and beyond visual line of sight so they could fly the drones from far away, not crash into things. They need to have a special radar. And that's another $250,000 a year just to be able to detect other flying objects like birds and planes and other drones.
Yeah. Okay. So sounds like a lot of money, but probably less than a fleet of helicopters would be.
That's right. Especially when you consider the fuel and the labor. And, you know, even when I was talking with the sheriff's office, sometimes it comes down to you don't have these helicopter pilots on 24/7. So if it's 3 o'clock in the morning and someone fled into the woods and you got to get a helicopter up, first you got to hope the helicopter pilot is awake,
yeah,
and aware and not other, you know, out of town,
yeah,
but also getting him there, getting an officer in the air and all that takes a lot more time and effort.
Yeah. Well, this has been fascinating. I've been talking with Cincinnati Enquirer reporter David Ferrara. Thanks so much for your time today, David.
Thank you very much, Lucy.
Up next, did you give thanks for the Bengals' win last week? We discuss the team's playoff chances. This is Cincinnati Edition. The Bengals are back in the hunt, and Joe Burrow's reunion tour with the team continues this weekend. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now to talk about the team's playoff chances and the importance of this weekend's game is Local 12 sports anchor and host of the Skinny Podcast, Richard Skinner. Welcome back, Skinny.
Hey, me, Lucy.
Okay, the Bengals won against the Ravens on Thanksgiving, and the defense was part of the win. Where did you see improvement?
Yeah, they've actually improved since the bye week, the last three games. If you take away a couple of defensive scores Pittsburgh had and a defensive score New England had, the Bengals defense has given up 20, 19, and 14 points in the last three games. With Joe Burrow back, if this defense gives up 20 points or less, it's not going to lose many games. I don't know if it can keep that up. But you've seen improved play against the run. They started to blitz more. Al Golden talked to him on Monday, and he, you know, mentioned that the more these guys have time on task, the more he's trusting some of the younger guys to do more things and put more things in on the defense. And quite frankly, they can't get enough of a pass rush if they don't blitz. So he's kind of had to do that out of necessity. But it's been very effective. It's a very small sample size. It's a three-game stretch. But it is a three-game stretch of improvement, and actually a three-game stretch where they've kind of improved in each of those three games. And as much as Joe Burrow coming back, and it's a big deal that he's back, this team wasn't going to make any run at a playoff berth without the defense getting better.
Well, I think the last time you and I talked was right before the Bengals bye week, and things were looking pretty bleak at that point. Did you see this improvement coming back then?
No, I don't think anybody did. I know there was some hope because you had two rookie linebackers who you know, they don't have a lot of experience in the league. They haven't seen a lot of things that the teams throw at them. And so you could expect them to make rookie mistakes. The problem is it's two rookies making rookie mistakes. Usually it's just one. You got maybe a rookie alongside of a veteran. They decided to roll the dice with two rookies, and they've gotten better. I can't tell you they've arrived, but they've gotten better. Barrett Carter, one of the rookies, has been flying around. He sometimes flies around not knowing where he's going, but he's been flying around making tackles of late. Demetrius Knight, the other rookie linebacker, had a big interception against Baltimore with the Bengals up 26-14. Defensive end Miles Murphy tipped that pass, and it fell right into his hands, but he was in the right position to make the play. And then Miles Murphy, it's interesting. Paul Daner Jr. from The Athletic and I both, I guess, had the same story idea because we went to talk to him after practice on Wednesday because he's been a disappointment up until the last 3 weeks. Team's first-round draft pick in 2023. Didn't do much as a rookie, didn't do anything last year. He had no sacks last year. And the last three games, he has started to take a step forward. He's been showing up, not to bog you down in numbers, but in the last three games, he's got 14 quarterback pressures. He didn't even have that in the first nine games combined this year. So he's starting to show signs of life, and they need that. I mean, when you draft the guy in the first round, he's in his third year. He needs to be contributing at a high level. And he's, I wouldn't say it's a high level at the moment, but it's at least a level that shows he's got a pulse.
Pulses are important out on the field.
Yes.
So are there any other standout defensive players on the team? It sounds like these young guys are really improving.
Yeah, DJ Turner, the cornerback's having a Pro Bowl year. I don't know if he still leads the league in passes defensed because sometimes stats will pop in late from like the Monday night game. But he's been leading the league in passes defensed since really early in the season. He's taken on some of the best wide receivers the other team has, and he's doing what's called traveling. So instead of some teams will line up a cornerback on the left side, another on the right side, and that's where they'll always play, and another guy will cover the slot guy. Wherever the best wide receiver on the other team's lining up, DJ Turner's going with him. He held the Bears' Rome Odunze, who's a fine second-year player, to no catches a few weeks ago. Held DK Metcalf to only a handful of catches in the couple of games the Steelers played against the Bengals. So he's been really good, and I think that's allowed Al Golden to probably use some of the blitz stuff more, where he can say, all right, I know DJ is going to shut down this guy. I can rotate some coverage to a couple of other guys and then still get away with blitzing people because I know DJ is going to shut things down. So DJ Turner has been really the one guy when this defense even stunk. He's been the one guy that's been consistently good really since he didn't even land a starting spot when the year started. He lost a starting spot in training camp and then got in very quickly and really showed that, hey, I'm ready to go. And he's been terrific all season long.
Well, the Bengals have had some injuries, even aside from Joe Burrow's turf toe. What's the update on T. Higgins? He suffered a concussion during the Patriots game against the Bengals, right? Yep.
Yep, actually, just cleared concussion protocol today, so he'll play on Sunday in Buffalo. That was trending in that direction. He practiced limited on Wednesday, and it is a protocol. I mean, you don't just say my concussion's gone. You have to go through some light exercises, then go through a full practice and show that you can respond to that. So there are steps you have to take to get out of concussion protocol. He suffered that concussion a couple of weeks ago against New England. There was no way he was going to play that Thursday night game in Baltimore. That means you're talking a 3-day turnaround. That just doesn't happen with this type of thing in the league. And so he's gone through the necessary steps and today got fully cleared. And so for the first time since the second game of the season against the Jacksonville Jaguars, the Bengals will have Joe Burrow, T. Higgins, and Ja'Marr Chase on the field at the same time.
Well, that sounds good. What about defensive end Trey Hendrickson? He's been out for a few games with an injury too.
Yeah, I don't think he's going to play again. He hasn't practiced all week. And he's still dealing with a hip/pelvis issue. When Zach Taylor on Mondays says a guy's doubtful, and that's what he said this past Monday, he said the last, I think, three Mondays that Trey's doubtful. That's an early indication that he's probably not going to play. And like I said, he hasn't practiced. So, you will not see Trey Hendrickson.
Yeah, you got to know how to interpret that language. It's like little kids thinking no means maybe, right? Okay, so we talked about Joe Burrow and his turf toe. He's back. How was he looking after the game against the Ravens? I mean, that it seemed like he was playing a lot after being out for such a long time.
Yeah, and I think that was the biggest question mark coming out of that game is how will it respond? I mean, athletes do it all the time, right? They fight through whatever the injury and pain is because of the, because of adrenaline. And then you get through the game, the adrenaline wears off, maybe whatever pain medication you are utilizing wears off and it feels even worse. And we talked to Zach Taylor on Friday after the game, and he really hadn't talked to Burrow at that point. So we had to wait until this week to kind of get a better indication. And when Joe talked to us on Wednesday, he said the toe feels perfectly fine. And he looked the part. I mean, if just watching him physically on Thursday night in Baltimore, if I didn't know he had a turf toe injury, I wouldn't have believed it. He just looked like the same old Joe Burrow. There was some rust. He completed only 15 of 32 passes in the first half and missed about four or five, according to Dan Pitcher, the offensive coordinator, that he normally makes. And again, that's attributed to rust. You haven't played in a while, and game speed is clearly different than practice speed. So some of that. But then in the second half, he completes 9 of 14 for over 100 yards and a couple of touchdowns on a couple of really good throws. And it looked like vintage Joe Burrow. And I think that's the other encouraging thing is, again, the more he kind of stacks games and practice reps and all those things, you're going to see very quickly literally the same old Joe Burrow that you saw the last few years.
Is he back sooner than you expected? I mean, there was a lot of talk about whether he'd come back at all, wasn't there?
Yeah, I mean, I think the initial target date was probably somewhere around maybe this next Baltimore game, December 16th, maybe the game after in Miami, or December 14th, and maybe the next game against Miami. So, yes, he did come back quicker. And I got to give him a lot of credit. I mean, he came back from the knee injury as good as new. He came back from the wrist injury and did show some rust with that. And we all wondered through training camp and even through the first stages of the season, him coming off the wrist injury of, oh man, is he okay? And this was last year. And then he finishes throwing for 43 touchdowns and almost 5,000 yards. And so this is a guy that he's had some serious injuries, but he seems to find the right way to attack his rehab process. I don't think to speed it up, but I think it does speed it up the way he attacks the process. And I think he was clearly back earlier than what we thought.
Yeah, it's good to be young too when you're hurt.
That helps.
Yeah. Well, let's take a moment to appreciate Joe Flacco. Do you think anybody out there would rather see that Joe playing at the quarterback position?
No, but I, to your point, I think that's a great point. I think a handful of us wrote that after what we thought was his last start, and it was the New England game, that the things that he did, I think, were really underappreciated because they lost two games that they should have won. The Jets game where they scored 38 and lost 39-38, and the Bears game where they scored 42 and lost 47-42. I mean, he did exactly what you hoped he would do, was put you in a position to win games, to be in a really good position to make a run at the playoffs when Joe Burrow came back. And he did that. Unfortunately, the record didn't reflect it. And so I think there should be an appreciation for what Joe Flacco did. I still go back to being signed on being traded for on a Tuesday and starting the next game, the very next game on a Sunday. You don't do that if you haven't been in the league for a long time. And even then, it's still very hard to do. And I thought he was just great. I loved his press conferences. I thought he was always insightful. I could tell he was really appreciative that, hey, I'm playing the game again at age 40, going on 41. I still get a chance to play, and just really reflective. And yeah, I think Joe Flacco should be very much appreciated for what he did. It's just unfortunate they didn't win games that he put him in position to win.
Yeah. Do you think the Bengals are still fortunate to have him on the roster just in case?
I do, yeah. A, just in case, and B, I mean, this is a guy that's started 18 years in this league and can be a great sounding board for Joe Burrow. And Joe Burrow's his own guy, and he sees things differently than other people, and that's kind of his superpower, as he sees and processes things very, very quickly. But Joe Burrow's a smart enough guy to go, hey, man, what did you see on this play? And use him as a sounding board. And so, yeah, I think having that veteran voice certainly helps.
Okay, here's the big question. With this win against the Ravens, what are the chances the Bengals could actually make the playoffs this year?
Well, it's at least you got a little life here. So here's what needs to happen. You have the Steelers and Ravens both have 6 losses. They each play each other twice more. So somebody's going to have maybe at least a 7th loss, if not both. And maybe somebody's going to have an 8th loss. The Ravens still have to play New England and at Green Bay. The Steelers still have to play at Detroit and at the Browns, which won't be an easy game for them. The Bengals still play the Ravens. The Bengals will have to beat the Ravens to stay mathematically in this. That would give the Ravens a 7th loss. Then you're looking for one of those other games for them to lose, which is a very real possibility. If you win out, you go 9-8. And the key is, if you go 9-8 and either Pittsburgh or Baltimore go 9-8, you'll be 5-1 in the division, and you'll have the divisional tiebreaker and you'll win the division. They could also lose, see, believe it or not, lose this Buffalo game, win out to go 8-9, which would again be a win over Baltimore, would give them a 5-1 division record. And in those schedules I just gave you for both Baltimore and Pittsburgh, which are difficult, it's conceivable they each lose 3 more games, and that would be 8-9 for them. And 8-9 might still win this division. I don't think it does. I do think 9-8 does. And if the Bengals win out, they're at 9-8. I think they win the division.
Wow. So I was thinking that this Sunday game was must win, but it's not necessarily must win for the Bengals to see postseason play.
Correct. It makes the math hard. Don't get me wrong. You're going to need a lot of help after that. And so you'd rather, you know, at least control a few more variables. But no, this game is not do or die. It'll make the math a little bit easier and a little more helpful. But no, they could actually finish 8-9 and win this division.
Do you think they have a chance to win Sunday?
I do. Buffalo's been very inconsistent. They just went to Pittsburgh and laid a whacking down on Pittsburgh pretty good. But that was Pittsburgh had a lot of self-inflicted wounds in that game, and they're kind of crumbling at the moment. But actually, the storylines out of Buffalo this week has been the inconsistency. Like, 1 week, Buffalo will look like a team that's been a perennial playoff team. The next week, they'll look like a dud. And it's just kind of gone back and forth. So they're coming off a good game. If form holds true, then they're ready for a dud. And we'll see if the Bengals can force them into that dud.
Okay. Well, I've been talking with Local 12 sports anchor and host of the Skinny Podcast, Richard Skinner. Thanks so much for your time today, Skinny.
You bet, Lucy. Anytime. Thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director today is Stephen Baum. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening. Hope you all have a great weekend.